The John Lott lectures are among the most distinguished lecture series in the world in philosophy. This series began in 1950, funded by a bequest from Henry Wilde. And this lecture is also supported by All Souls College and by OUP. This one is the 53rd series of John Lott lectures, and we're delighted that they will be given by Professor Richard Pettigrew. Richard Pettigrew is a professor of philosophy at Bristol University, where he spent all his career and where he was also a graduate student. But we can also be proud because he was an undergraduate in maths and philosophy here at Oxford. His research has ranged widely across philosophy of mathematics, decision theory, epistemology, ethics, and political theory. His books include Accuracy and the Laws of Credence, 2016, Choosing for Changing Selves, 2019, Epistemic Risk and the Demands of Rationality, 2022, all of those published with OUP, and in addition, two contributions to CUP's Elements in Decision Theory series in 2020, The Dutch Book Argument, and most recently, Opinion Pooling, 2025, co-authored with Lee Elkin. This wide range of interests is also evident in the plan for our lecture series. The title of the series as a whole is From a Point of View, and as you will have seen from the online descriptions, Richard will be ranging very widely on both theoretical and practical issues in rationality. There will be six lectures altogether, and after each we'll have a brief 5 minute or so break for people who want to leave, and then we'll have a brief discussion period. After this first lecture, after the discussion period, we will have a drinks reception upstairs sponsored by OUP. So, with no more ado, the title of this first lecture is Nothing But the Truth, Accuracy, Epistemic Value, and Epistemic Rationality. Let's welcome you.
Thank you very much, Ursula, and thank you very much to everybody for coming, particularly on a sunny day when you could have been sitting in the parks. It's an enormous honour to give this lecture series, and particularly in the city where I fell in love with philosophy, and indeed in the presence of some of the people who helped me fall in love, Dan Isaacson and Dave Leal are both here, and with the memory of other people who aren't here, John Foster, who's my college tutor, and Kathy Wilkes, who's actually the person who's instrumental in me applying to graduate school in the first place, the person who sort of suggested that that might be something I'd be interested in. So it's a wonderful experience. So as Ursula mentioned, the topic, the questions I want to be exploring in these lectures are to do with the point of view that we take on the world, the perspective from which we approach the world. And I'm taking that perspective to be made up of various components. So there's a sort of belief component, determines sort of what you think the world is like. There's also other components that are kind of value-like components that contain your desires, your preferences, your wants, and so on. You might think of them as determining the way you'd like the world to be. And then there's further components which are less often talked about, for instance, the attitudes that you take to risk. I'll be talking a little bit more about those in the second lecture. I'm going to be interested particularly in normative questions about these points of view. And I'm going to be interested, so the questions I'm interested in sort of divide up into three categories, and Ursula's already sort of mentioned that they kind of range across the theoretical, the practical, and the moral. So the first couple of lectures are really about theoretical rationality. So I'm particularly interested there in the kind of belief component of your point of view and normative questions concerning that. For instance, how do we build that point of view? How do you come by the beliefs that you have? And what sort of norms govern the end state of that process? What norms govern the beliefs that you have at the end? But also, how does that process, how does that part of your point of view sort of evolve forward as you experience different things as, for instance, you gather new empirical evidence from the world, but also as you undergo logical reasoning, as you can undergo conceptual clarification, also, for instance, as you build your kind of repertoire of concepts so that you can represent more things in the world and you can consider possibilities that weren't possible before. So that's the sort of first couple of lectures. The second couple of lectures moves on to practical rationality, although I don't quite take us away from epistemology straight away, because the third lecture is about the sort of practical rationality of epistemology in particular. How do we make decisions about how we gather evidence? How do we make decisions about the materials that we gather from the world in order to build our point of view? How do we decide when to undergo logical reasoning? When do we decide when to work on our concepts, either to build new concepts or undergo some sort of conceptual clarification? That's in the third lecture, but the fourth lecture is more purely in practical rationality. That's going to be concerning kind of decision theory proper, if you like, sort of really trying to understand from the points of view that we have, how should we make decisions when we're faced with them. And then the final couple of lectures concern ethical questions, two sorts of ethical questions. In the fifth lecture, I'm interested in the way in which how we build our point of view has an effect on the normative status of actions that we take from our point of view. So I'm going to be particularly interested in acts like giving consent in this kind of situation. So when is consent effective, and particularly when does the way that the preferences on which the consent is given determine when it's effective? And then in the final lecture, I'm going to be interested in this question about how points of view should treat one another, is one way to put it. And spell out other ways of putting it later on, but I'm particularly interested in how perhaps I, from the particular point of view that I inhabit now with the beliefs and desires and values and preferences I have now, how should I treat myself at a later point in my life or an earlier point in my life when I inhabit a different point of view which might disagree with me. So that's a sort of overview of what's going on with the lectures. There's a couple of themes that may be worth highlighting to begin with. One of them is that I'm going to end up with a sort of permissive conception, or permissive account of the norms that govern a lot of the items that I'm talking about, a lot of the items that go into these points of view, the beliefs that we have, values that we have, the actions that we perform, and so on. So I don't think that rationality, for instance, is going to specify a single set of beliefs that one must have given the evidence you have. Different people with the same evidence can end up having different beliefs on the basis of that evidence, and they can still be perfectly rational. It's perfectly rational for people to have different values and preferences and so on. And it's going to turn out that there's a whole range of problems that arise if your conception of normativity is permissive like that. In some ways it seems sort of surprising. You might think, well, look, if things are kind of more permissive, how do more problems arise? Surely it's when things get more kind of constrained, that's when the problems really kind of kick in, but actually that's not really the case. For lots of these cases, we're going to see that problems arise specifically because the norms that I'm going to try to persuade you of are permissive. So I was thinking of calling the lecture series Living with Permissivism, and I thought no one's ever heard of what permissivism is. It's a ridiculous title for it. But in some ways, that's one of the themes that's going to run through. How do we deal with the fact that normativity doesn't pin us down to a single way of believing or way of acting. And then the other theme that sort of runs through some of the lectures, not through all of them, is what I'm calling a sort of teleological account of the foundations of certain parts of our normativity, particularly normativity of beliefs, but it's also going to turn out for some of the practical rationality questions and even some of the questions about morality. That is, I'm going to take a view that some of the items that we're talking about, these items that make up these points of view that I'm interested in, they have certain goals, and we can evaluate how proficiently they play those roles, or how proficiently they sort of achieve or let us get at these goals. And then we can understand the value of these items by how well they kind of play the role of getting at these goals. And then on the basis of that, we can use these facts about their value to build up the norms, establish the norms, and indeed, something I'm going to advertise later on as an advantage of this approach, they don't just allow us to establish these norms, they're also going to explain why the norms end up being true. Okay, so that's a little bit of an overview of what's happening. In this lecture, as I said, I'm going to be interested particularly in the sort of epistemic part of our points of view. The beliefs that we have, what are the norms that govern them, and what are the basis for those sorts of norms? And I'm going to try to spell out some of this teleological account of it. I'm going to go through this. There's, as we'll see as we kind of move on, there's sort of formal apparatus in the background of a lot of this, but I'm not going to go into the formal apparatus. Partly it would take a lot of time to kind of build it up. There's a whole sort of nuances that would sort of, I think, distract from some of the philosophical upshots of this. I'm happy to discuss any of it in questions, but I've also put up a rather sort of lengthy, in the end, appendix of this on the, there's a link to it at the top of the handout, if anyone really wants to kind of dive into the gory details behind some of this. But what I'm going to present is not going to be technical at all, or at least it's not going to rely on understanding any of that kind of technical background. I'm going to talk through everything that needs to be understood. Okay, so to introduce these norms, I'm going to introduce a kind of character who's going to be our kind of running protagonist for all of the examples throughout the first few lectures, at least. Verity is, and she's going to be the she's going to be the sort of central figure in the examples I'm going to use to kind of illustrate the framework I'm going to set up. So the first question is, how do we represent Verity's belief states, the belief component of her point of view? Well, like all of us, she's uncertain about lots of things, and like all of us, her uncertainty comes in different degrees. So, for instance, she's more confident that Oxford is east of Bristol than she is that Bath's east of Bristol. Lots of propositions like that where she has different degrees of... it seems to be more confident in one thing than the other. Now, there's a range of ways that we might represent someone in that situation. So you might think we should represent her as believing something about the strength of her evidential support, having some sort of full belief concerning how strongly her evidence supports the different propositions. So, for instance, we might think that she believes her evidence supports, the proposition that Oxford's east of Bristol, more strongly than it supports the proposition that Bath is east of Bristol. The problem with that is that it runs into trouble if you don't think there are these sorts of facts around. Well, it's going to run into trouble if we, as the kind of attributor to her, don't think there are these sorts of facts, and then we're going to be attributing to her false beliefs. We might be able to represent her in that way, but it seems sort of that we wouldn't want to represent her necessarily if we don't need to, as having false beliefs. The other problem is that Verity herself doesn't think there are these sorts of facts around. She just doesn't think there are facts about how strongly evidence supports propositions. And we're going to see in the second lecture she doesn't think there are such facts. So we want a different way of representing her, and one natural way to do that is to say, rather than having a full belief about some graded fact, she has partial beliefs or credences or degrees of confidence or levels of confidence. So, for instance, we might think that she has a higher credence in the proposition that Oxford's east of Bristol than she does in the proposition that Bath is east of Bristol. For instance, we might try to measure these using kind of precise numerical values, 86% credence that Bath's east of Bristol, 98% credence that Oxford's east of Bristol. These aren't the only ways that you can go about representing people in this case. These are the kind of representational choices I'm going to be making for these lectures. Again, sort of happy to talk about the alternatives and what and why or why not you might want to use those. It'll actually come up in the fourth lecture why I'm going to argue against one of the standard alternatives to this, but that's a little bit far in the future. Okay, so that's the idea. We're going to kind of represent her as having these kind of different degrees of belief, and they can be measured by these kind of numerical values. What are the contents that Verity ascribes these degrees of belief to? This is going to become very important in Lecture 3, where I'm going to wanting to give an account of these contents that allows us to model logical learning, conceptual clarification, conceptual learning, conceptual expansion, and other sorts of things. And so I'm going to go into a lot more detail in that lecture, Lecture 3, about that, because in Lecture 3 I'm interested in inquiry, and I think inquiry should include both kind of logical inquiry and conceptual inquiry as well as empirical inquiry. But here I'm going to just go for, in some ways, the simplest version of this. Okay. So the idea is that we're going to represent Verity as having different, well, I'm going to call them personal possibilities, and that's the language we're going to come back to in Lecture 3. This is kind of language due to Ian Hacking originally. So these are sort of possibilities from Verity's points of view. So we don't think of them as kind of full possible worlds in some kind of grand Lewisian sense where every single proposition gets a true or a false at it. Rather, we think of them as representing the world at the level of the finest level of grain that Verity herself can represent the world at. So they don't make any distinctions that she can't make, but they do make all of the distinctions that she can make. So we imagine her having kind of representational apparatus allows her to make some certain distinctions, and these kind of personal possibilities for Verity are going to be the kind of different possible states of the world, but not at the finest possible level of grain where they specify all the truths, but just at the level of grain at which Verity can understand them. Where Verity can make those distinctions. Okay, so that's going to be her possibilities, and then once we've got that, then we just do the kind of more standard thing to just say that the contents that she's assigning these credences to are just going to be understood as something, and we might call them like personal propositions, when those are just going to be understood as sets of these personal possibilities. Okay, so that might have sounded like a sort of a lot of setup for, given that it's going to is looking like a reasonably standard picture, but I'm sort of introducing a version of the setup that can then be sort of tweaked to include possibilities that are going to allow Verity to be uncertain of logical facts and have different credences in logically equivalent facts, and to be unaware of, say, necessary a posteriori facts. But we're going to come back to that in Lecture 3. And for the purpose of all the setup at the moment, I'm not going to go into that. I'm also just going to assume for the purposes here, and this is in some ways just a sort of technical thing, that we're going to assume this set of personal possibilities are just finite at the moment. So it's finite in many of them. You can do pretty much everything that I'm going to say here in an infinite setting, but the technical stuff just gets much more complicated and is, I think, a little bit more a kind of work in progress than the material I'll present here. Okay, so that's how we're going to represent Percy. So she has different propositions, are understood as sets of personal possibilities, and she assigns credences to them, and that represents her kind of the belief component of her her point of view. And then we're going to be interested in certain norms that govern these. And in some ways, these are going to, I'm just going to go through here, just in some ways the most basic sort of norms that you need for the sort of framework that I'm setting up, which is the sort of standard framework for credal epistemology to do with credences. And these are going to be norms that do two sorts of things. On the one hand, they're going to tell you how your credences and different propositions at the same time hang together, how they relate to one another. So they're sort of coherence constraints. And in fact, we'll see a kind of, some ways, precise sense in which they're coherence constraints later on. Because what they say, at least the first one that I'm going to be interested in, this one I'm calling probabilism, essentially what that amounts to, it's going to turn out in the end, is that Verity should have credences that amount to a single point of view. They encode a single point of view on the world. If she violates this norm that I'm going to talk about, this probabilism norm, it's going to end up, in some ways, her credences end up encoding a number of different views on the world within the same sort of set of credences. And that's going to become a little bit more precise later on. But that's the way to think about this sort of norm. And so it may be familiar to some people, but it's essentially a norm that says that her credences over her personal possibilities, remember these are just the kind of ways the world could be, grained as finely as she can with her representational apparatus. Her credences over those should just add up to one, okay, to 100%. You should end up adding up to 100%. And then her credence in each of the personal propositions, these things that are represented as sets of possibilities, should just end up being the sum of her credences in the possibilities that make it true, the possibilities that make it up. So, for instance, let's imagine that Verity's a doctor and she's got a patient in front of her. She doesn't know whether the patient has a disease or not. She's sent out for a test. The test is going to come back either positive or negative. And Verity has a range of credences in this. She's got credences in the kind of fine-grained possibilities that the test comes back positive, the patient does have the disease, comes back positive, they don't have the disease, negative, they have the disease, negative, they don't have the disease. So those are four possibilities. But she also has... credences in kind of propositions, more kind of coarse-grained representations. So, for instance, she's got a credence just that the test will come back positive, the thing that's true at the two possibilities there. And what probabilism demands is that her credence in the proposition is just the sum of her credences in those two possibilities where it's true. So that's a kind of norm that governs your credences at any particular time. But you also want to know some sort of norm that governs how your credences should evolve as new evidence comes in. And at the moment, given the way I've kind of set this up, we can think of the evidence coming in as empirical evidence. We learn something about the world. For instance, in the standard way of doing this, you learn a particular proposition is true. But as we'll see in Lecture 3, you can also use this to model logical learning or conceptual learning, where what you're doing is not learning some empirical fact from the world, but you're learning some logical fact, or you're kind of learning something about the concepts that you have. But at the moment, you might just think of it as kind of learning an empirical proposition. And you might, for instance, think in this case, Verity might just learn the test came back positive. She opens up the test envelope, it says positive, she learns a particular proposition. How should she update her credences having done that? And the answer is just the sort of standard one that's used in this context, which just says she should set all of her credences and the possibilities that she's now ruled out by that piece of learning down to zero, and she should raise up all the other ones by the same amount, or the same factor actually, in order that they end up adding up to one. So in this case, she learns it's positive, she puts her credences that it's negative down to zero, and all the possibilities it's negative down to zero, she multiplies all the rest by 10 to get up to everything adding up to one again. And there's kind of two norms actually in this kind of area. One of them is the norm that says this is what you should in fact do. Evidence, you've got your credences, evidence comes in, you've got to do something. What should you do in that situation? The norm that says update in this way, sometimes I call it actual conditionalization. But there's another norm, and in some ways that's going to become, it's going to become important partly because we have a whole range of arguments for it, and I'm going to spell out some of those. But it also becomes important because these are the norms that are important when it comes to inquiry in Lecture 3. So I'll give it here. It's called plan conditionalization, and it doesn't put down some norm that governs the relationship between your credences now and your credences after you learn some evidence, but rather between your credences now and your current plan for how you will update upon receipt of new evidence. So you can imagine Verity sitting there, hasn't opened up the test result envelope yet, and the patient might say to her, so what are you going to think if it's positive? What are you going to think if it's negative? That's her plan for how she's going to update. She's got a plan for what will happen if she opens it and she knows it's positive, plan if she learns that it's negative. And what the plan conditionalization says is she should just plan to update in this way. There's actually a little bit of a subtlety to this, that you should only do this in situations, or at least the norm only says you should do it in situations, where the possible evidence you might receive forms a partition and it's factive. So what you're going to learn is going to be true, and also it's going to be the case that the possible pieces of evidence you should learn partition up the space neatly. There's no overlap between them. If you do that, as Miriam Schoenfield showed, and I'll come on to a bit later on, you shouldn't update by conditionalization. You should do something very related to it, but you shouldn't do that. And actually, in some ways, there's now a kind of whole literature that debates whether Schoenfield's suggestion is quite right and offers alternatives. So again, I'm happy to talk about. Okay, so those are, in some ways, the really standard, basic principles that guide this sort of account of how you should reason under uncertainty. You've got the representational side, which says this is how we should represent your belief state, and here's a couple of sort of very basic norms. They give sort of structural norms that govern you any particular time, and then kind of evolution norms that tell you how your point of view should develop over time. There are some subtleties here. For one thing, you may naturally think that we don't always receive evidence in that particular way. We don't always just learn a particular proposition is true, or at least we don't just learn a proposition is true that we previously had opinions about, or that we're able to articulate in our idiolect. So you can imagine, for instance, if Verity's, when she opens the test, it's not just going to say positive or negative. It's rather going to say, be a sort of histology slide from a biopsy or something like that. And she's going to examine this histology slide. She's a kind of expert on oncologist. But even expert oncologists aren't such that when they see that, they can exactly express in a single proposition in their idiolect all the information that they get from that. And so you might think that quite often we get evidence that's a bit like that. You couldn't say exactly, in your using your representational capacities, what exactly the full, strongest piece of evidence you've got. You say certain things like, you know, there's a sort of something worrying over here. You could say certain sorts of things, but you couldn't say everything that you get. So what do you do in that situation? Well, I mean, the sort of complexities about this, but essentially the idea is, it's difficult to state norms for this because you don't know exactly what the kind of input is that is that you're going to state the norms in terms of. But you can say something about what the output of the process should be like. So suppose you have dispositions to react to this. Say Verity has dispositions to react to this histology slide in a particular way. So she wouldn't be able to articulate it because she wouldn't be able to articulate the triggering conditions for this disposition. She wouldn't be able to say, if I see exactly this, then I'll do this, because if she can say, I'll see exactly this, then she would be able to express the thing that she might learn. But if she has dispositions that might that would be triggered in certain situations and give rise to different credences, then you can ask, what should those dispositions be like? And the answer is, stated by this principle, the answer that I think is correct is stated by this principle I'm calling the weak reflection principle that Van Frassen introduces. And one way to understand it, I won't go into it, what it says is that your current credences should be a kind of mixture of the possible future credences that you could get upon receipt of the new evidence. So they should sort of sit in the middle, if you like. They should sort of look like this. This is you, this is Verity. This is kind of Verity sitting here currently. This is her current credences. And suppose her dispositions, there's different triggering conditions that she might receive upon seeing the histology slide. And suppose one of them would give her this as her credences, the other one would give her this, one would give her this, one would give her this. Essentially what the weak reflection principle says is that her current credences should sit inside this. They should be a mixture, there should be a weighted average of these. But another way of stating this is to say she should update in a way that could be recovered as if she had updated by conditionalizing. So there's a kind of enrichment of her conceptual space where she does now, is able within this enriched conceptual space to say precisely the things that she learns from when she looks at the histology slide. It's an enrichment of it such that in that enriched space, and you can extend her credences to that enriched space, such that within that enriched space, she does in fact update by conditioning on the thing that she learns. Okay. So that's the weak reflection principle. And then finally, just before we move on, I'm just going to state, although this is probably more familiar than other parts, is the kind of principle of correct action for people who think about kind of epistemology in this kind of creedal way. Because one attractive thing, one thing I'm going to kind of advertise as a kind of nice feature of this way of approaching epistemology is that it provides a unified account of the kind of norms that govern the belief part of our point of view, but then also governs the behaviour that we should, the actions that we should take on the basis of it. So this is just, I'm just calling it the expected utility principle, people have other sorts of names for it. This just says if you've got to make a decision between a range of options, a range of options become available to you. You could come and see a lecture on points of view in creedal epistemology, or you could sit in the parks and sit PIMS. Then in that situation, how should you make your decision? Well, you should choose whatever one of the options that maximizes expected utility. What does that mean? We should go through each of the options. You should go through each of the possibilities. Say how valuable that possibility, that particular option would be. In that possibility, how valuable would it be to come to a lecture on points of view if it told you all the truths about creedal rationality? How likely it is that going to the lecture would indeed teach you all the facts about creedal rationality? You don't have to report that to me. Take that credence that it's going to give you all that kind of wonderful information and use that credence to discount the utility of the value that you would give to it in that situation. And then take all the other different possibilities and take how valuable it would be in those possibilities, discount those by how likely it is you think those possibilities will come about, and add up those discounted utilities, and then that gives your expectation of the utility, and then you pick one of the ones that maximises that value. I'm stating that not because that's obviously not really a part of the kind of epistemic norms, but it's going to be useful in some of the things we're going to see as we go on. Okay. So that's the framework. That's how we're going to represent our agents, subjects, individuals, subjective epistemic evaluation. We're going to represent verities having these credences, making decisions on the basis of them, and they're evolving them in this way. And then we're going to ask, why are those the correct norms? What is it about those norms that violating them all can make verity go wrong in some way? What are the grounds for those norms? And I'm going to offer a teleological account of those norms of rationality. So the starting point is something like this. There are at least two roles that our beliefs or our credences play in our lives. At least two roles. I'm not saying there aren't more. They're supposed to represent the world. We use them to represent the world. They're the kind of way that we view the world. They kind of encode how we think the world is. But they also guide action. So they're supposed to play these two roles. And whenever you've got some item that's supposed to play a particular role, then you can evaluate how well it plays that role in any particular situation. And then the idea is that we can then establish norms to govern these particular items, be they beliefs or actions or moral principles, by showing that one of the items that violates these norms or principles will play these roles suboptimally. So in the belief case, the one that I'm talking about today, I'm interested in the roles that are the items of our the epistemic components of our point of view play. These represent the world and they guide action. I'm going to give you an account of how to measure how well they play those particular roles. And then I'm going to show that you can establish all the things that I've been talking about just by looking at these measures of how well these credences play these two roles that I say are kind of central roles for them. Before I do that, just a kind of word on what I take to be the advantages of this account of rationality. So this is quite distinct from a lot of accounts of the kind of foundations for normativity in epistemology. So here are some of the advantages. I'm not going to tell you the disadvantages. I can wait till Q&A. I'll at least give the advertising pitch. So one advantage, I think, is, as often is the case, I think, for these accounts that are in some sense not quite instrumentalist, but they're based on a kind of account of the value of the objects, is that the items that you're kind of describing norms for, is that they lean a little bit less heavily on appeals to intuitive responses to vignettes, a sort of standard methodology that we use all over the place in analytic epistemology, where you kind of present a particular case and you ask, does the person look justified in this case? Do they look rational in this case? Something like that. And you take those together to be some sort of body of data, and then you hope that your norms are going to be such that they capture that data. I'm not going to claim that this approach doesn't in any way lean on these. That's just not true. But it does lean a little bit less heavily on this. I think that this approach has one advantage, that I think it establishes the norms that we're interested in, but it doesn't just establish that they're true, but explain why they're true. And that's something that, again, you might not get from a methodology that is based a lot on appeal to sort of intuitive reactions to vignettes. Why? Because just being able to kind of capture that data that's given by those intuitive reactions may persuade you that indeed the norm must be correct. So it's kind of the best explanation of us having these intuitive reactions to the vignettes, but it doesn't really explain why it is that the norm holds. This is meant to be an advantage of this. It also allows us, and this is a little bit more controversial, I'll come to an instance of it in the second lecture, allows us to question intuitively plausible epistemic principles. So one thing that's difficult if you're relying a lot on intuition is cases where there's something that has a lot of intuitive support, it's very difficult to then find kind of compelling arguments against it. This allows something like this. And one nice thing, I think, in some ways, I think probably the thing that attracted me to this approach right at the beginning was that it accommodates, I think, both internalism and externalism as different dimensions of evaluation rather than competing ones. It might seem an odd sort of thing to say about a teleological conception of, or account of rationality. Because you might think, well, the teleological view looks extremely externalist. We're going to be evaluating credences by how well they represent the world. Well, that's not something that we have sort of purely internal access to, or how well they guide action. But of course, how well you guide action doesn't just depend on what you do, which may be internally accessible, but also on how the world is and responds to you and kind of helps to determine the value of what you get. And that's correct. Each of these ways of evaluating is in some ways an externalist one. It's one that you don't have internal access to. But nonetheless, and I think one of the beauties of this approach is that you can establish internalist norms, but something that's much closer to what we think of as internalist norms, but using these externalist principles. And we'll see this particularly when I come to kind of talking about the argument for probablism as we go on. Okay, so I'm just going to talk quickly about how we go about measuring these, how well these credences play these different roles. So how do we measure the epistemic utility, for instance, of a credal state? That's going to be a measure of how good it is in playing this role of representing the world. Now, there's a natural way, I think, to think about this, and it's the way that kind of got this project, this kind of approach off the ground. It's the way of saying, well, your credences better represent the world if you have, say, higher credences in something that's true and lower credences in something that's false. That's a natural thing to think. I have higher credence than you do that it's sunny, and indeed it is sunny, then I'm doing better in some way at representing the world. Of course, this is more difficult than in the full belief case, where it's kind of natural to say what it means to represent the world accurately. But this is a notion of gradational accuracy that Jim Joyce introduces in a 1998 paper, and has sort of been the guiding principle for a lot of the work in this on this approach. But it's not absolutely necessary that we see things like that. And the two properties of the measure of epistemic utility that I'm going to talk about don't obviously allude to that conception of epistemic utility. So I'll just state them now. I'm not going to go into arguments for them again. I'm happy to talk about those, but that would sort of be a lecture in itself, the arguments for them and the potential worries about them. But I'll state them here, and we'll carry on. So the first one just is that these measures of epistemic value, epistemic utility, how good your credences are at representing the world, they are continuous functions of the credences that you have. So you can sort of imagine Verity looking out her window and seeing dark clouds accumulate on the horizon, and as that happens, her credences kind of continuously rise up towards 80% that it's going to rain, something like that. She kind of gradually moves up to that. And the continuous claim just says that in that situation, similarly, the epistemic utility, the epistemic value of her credences continuously approaches whatever the epistemic value is of 80% credence in that, which will be quite high epistemic value if it does indeed rain and quite a low one if it doesn't rain. So they're continuous functions of those. That may well just look like a kind of technical sort of assumption. In some ways it is, but it is absolutely necessary for this. We know that a lot of these arguments just can't work in a non-continuous case. I'm also going to assume, in some ways this is often thought of as the really heavy-duty assumption in this area, that the ways of measuring epistemic value are what's called strictly proper. And what does that mean? It just means that if Verity does satisfy probabilism, so her credences really are probabilistic in the way that I said, then she's immodest. She's immodest in the following way. She expects herself to be doing best. So she can think about, use her own credences to evaluate everybody else's credences. She looks around the room, she looks at all the other kind of continuously many people in elsewhere in the universe who, with all the different possible credences they could have, and she evaluates each one of them from the point of view of her own credences. She says she uses her own credences and she evaluates herself, and then she evaluates all the other possibilities. And what strict propriety says is that she ends up concluding that she's doing best. Okay. She obviously knows that there's another thing that will, in fact, do better. So she'll know that either having zero in rain or one in rain would be doing better than having 80% in rain. Zero would be doing better if it's false, one would be doing better if it's true. But from her own point of view, looking at other specific, rigidly designated credences, she thinks of each one of them as doing worse than her. Okay, so that's the strict propriety thing. Like I say, there's a kind of whole range sort of cottage industry in some ways of arguments in favour of that that I won't go into. Okay, and then the second thing we need to do here is to measure. So I talked there about the epistemic utility of a credal state and our understanding that as how well the credences do at representing the world. But there's also this other thing, the pragmatic utility of a credal state, and that's how well it does at guiding actions. So here the account is based on this this idea that comes out of a kind of pragmatist tradition in the early 20th, first half of the 20th century, and particularly Janina Hossiassen's work, sort of largely forgotten work that's recently been sort of revived, and I'm going to be talking a lot more about in the third lecture, because she really is the beginning of the value of information and the kind of credal approach to inquiry literature. So I'll talk a lot more about it there, but the account that she gives, the sort of insight that she has, is that you can value credences for their kind of decision-making power in the following way. Suppose you're going to face a particular decision, you've got certain credences or beliefs, then you can value them for their kind of ability to, their kind of action guiding power by asking what the utility would be, what the value would be at the particular possibility you're interested in of the action that those credences would lead you to choose. So in some ways, it's a very natural thought. How good is it from an action-guiding point of view to have these credences? Well, it's however good the thing is that they would lead you to choose. Very kind of, you can see it's a kind of pragmatist view in some ways, the sort of view that naturally comes out of people like Peirce and James in the late 19th century. So that's the idea. There's a couple of things to tweak, though, because we don't always know what decision we're going to face. So Hossiassen's definition assumes that we've got a decision in front of us, we've got our credences. How good are the credences? They're as good as the option from the decision that they lead you to choose. But of course, we don't always know what they are. And in some ways, one of the purposes of credences is that they're all purpose. They're there whichever decision you come about. You don't craft your credences in order to face a particular decision. And so you should be able to kind of evaluate, for someone who's uncertain what decision they're going to face with their credences, evaluate how good those credences are. But then there's a natural thing to do in that situation, and this kind of is kind of borrowing from work by Mark Shervish and Ben Levenstein, that you put a probability distribution over the different decisions that you might face, and then how good is some credences at a particular possibility. Well, it's the kind of expectation of how good it would be to use those, where the uncertainty is now over the decision that you'll face. Okay, so that's the kind of Hossiassen account of the pragmatic utility of a credal state, as I say, kind of enhanced with this this kind of approach where you're uncertain about what decision you'll face. Now, one question that arises here, though, we know how someone should choose in the face of a particular decision. If their credences are probabilistic, they should maximise expected utility. That's one of the kind of principles that we were interested in. But what happens if their credences are not probabilistic? And then it turns out there's actually a kind of array of different possibilities, different ways that norms that might govern how someone should choose if their credences aren't actually satisfying the kind of probability norm that I put up. I won't go into those in a lot of detail, but this is really where it comes up that if your credences don't satisfy probabilism, if they don't satisfy that norm, they really end up encoding various different points of view. Essentially, what ends up happening is that from the point of view of different ways of combining your credences and different propositions, you could end up making different choices when faced with that particular decision. And that's the sense in which there's a sort of a range of different possible points of view encoded in these credences that are not probabilistic. I've got an example there on the handout, but I won't go into that in too much detail. But essentially, you have this situation where someone is choosing between two options, let's say Verity's deciding what walk to go on tomorrow. She's either going to walk around Loch Mick, which is a flat walk with some tree cover, or she's going to climb Ben McDewey, which is a mountain. And it really matters whether it's going to be sunny or rainy. If it's rainy, she really doesn't want to be going up the mountain. If it's sunny, it'd be wonderful to go up the mountain, amazing views. And suppose her credences are sort of incoherent, they're not probabilistic in the particular way that's on the handout. It turns out there's two ways that she can make this decision. She can use the fine-grained partition, which specifies not just the weather on Monday, but also the weather on Tuesday. She can do expected utility calculations with respect to that. And if she does that, she'll choose to walk around Loch Mick. But if she uses the more coarse-grained one, which she's also able to use, given the way that the utilities are set in this problem, she'll choose the opposite. She'll choose Ben McDewey. So that's the sense in which she's kind of got this two different points of view encoded in her credences. They'll take two different views on what to choose in that situation. And it turns out that's enough to ensure that this way of measuring the pragmatic utility of your credences has the properties that we also ascribed to the ways of measuring the epistemic utility of your credences. So they also end up becoming continuous, which that condition that serves a little bit, artificial, but also strictly proper. It's going to end up that Verity, from her own point of view, will prefer, to, as long as her credence is over the decisions that she might face is kind of widely spread enough, it's going to end up that she will prefer to use her own credences over anybody else's to make these decisions. Okay, if she's got to use some credences when making her decisions, she will expect using her own ones is better than all the others. Okay. Now, what's really, so these two conditions that I've been talking about, continuity, strict propriety, you might think, maybe there's some plausibility to them, but why those two? What are they? What are the payoffs? So now, hopefully, I'm going to sort of explain some of the payoff of these, is that just assuming those two things, you can establish a wide range of norms about credences. Okay, and I'll just go through these now. So let's just assume that we're measuring either the pragmatic utility, which is the kind of how good your credences are at helping you to make decisions, or the epistemic utility, how good your credences are at representing the world. Those were measuring one or other of those things. And suppose they have these two properties that I'm interested in, then we can give the following arguments for the different norms that I was describing before. We're going to, so I'm just going to introduce a little bit of terminology that's kind of from decision theory. One, suppose you're trying to evaluate a range of different options. We're going to say that one option strongly dominates another if, at any possibility, that first option is strictly better than that second one. So it's like the option, suppose I give you an option and then I give you as an alternative that option plus I give you £10. Then the second one strictly dominates, presuming you give positive utility to getting £10. Then that second option strongly dominates the first one. It's better regardless of how the world turns out. So if you don't take an option, if you do take an option that is strongly dominated, you're kind of leaving free utility on the table. That's the way to think about it. There's some alternative thing you could have done which just guaranteed to be better. Regardless of how the world is, it will be better. So it's sort of kind of no-brainer situations. That's the sort of idea. Okay, so now what do we get? Well, first of all, we get this kind of dominance argument for probabilism, which has a kind of extraordinarily long history of people proving kind of variance on it until we get to the version that I'm presenting now, which I think is, to some extent now, I think we know to be the strongest result you could possibly get. And this just says if your credences don't satisfy probabilism, so if you don't have credences in line with that probabilism norm that I gave you, then you're strongly dominated. There's alternatives that are guaranteed to be better. So if you're incoherent in that way, if you violate probabilism, then you're leaving free either epistemic utility or pragmatic utility on the table. a pragmatic case. There are other credences that you could have had that are guaranteed to be better guides to action than yours are. And there are other credences that are guaranteed to better represent the world than you are. So that's the argument for that. There's also arguments for actual conditionalization. That's the one I said, when evidence comes in, you should update on it by conditionalizing, which the process that I talked about. The argument there is a little bit strange, and I'm still not, I suppose, not entirely certain what I make of it. So it's an argument that Hannes Leitgeb and I gave a while ago, and I sort of disavowed it for a long time, and have now come to quite like it again. So the idea is, first of all, you might think, okay, so I'm here with my credentials, I get some information, some new evidence, now I've got to decide what to do. Well, that looks like an action. That looks like a choice I've got to make. But we know how I'm supposed to make choices. I'm supposed to maximize expected utility. So I use my credentials and I maximize expected epistemic utility or pragmatic utility. But the problem is, because we've assumed strict propriety, the thing that I will then expect to be best is just to stick with the ones I have. That's what it means. What Hannes and I thought was, perhaps in that situation where you've got new evidence that's ruled out certain possibilities, you shouldn't do the usual expected utility calculation where you do this kind of discounted utilities across all different possibilities. You take the utility of each possibility, discount it by the probability of credence in that possibility, add them all up. You should just do it over the worlds that remain sort of possible for you, epistemically possible for you, the ones that haven't been ruled out by your evidence. And if you do that, it turns out that you get back this norm of conditionalization. So it sort of goes via an unconventional sort of bit of decision theory, but I think maybe is the correct thing to use in that situation. There are other sorts of arguments that you can give for if what you're interested in is plan conditionalization. That's the one that says, remember, you've got certain credences, how should you plan to update on the basis of them? Well, there's an argument that Hilary Graves actually and David Wallace gave that in that situation, if you're sort of starting off with probabilistic credences, then the plan that you expect to do best is going to be the plan to conditionalize. And there's an argument that Ray Briggs and I gave that shows that if you plan to update in any way other than by conditioning, then there's alternative credences and a plan that you could have that dominates you. So that gives a slightly different kind of argument for this. The first one gives us an argument for the narrow scope norm. If you have these priors, then you should plan to do this. The second one gives an argument for the wide scope norm. It gives an argument for you should have a prior and a plan that relate like this. So we have those two. There's also a dominance argument for the weak reflection principle as well. But that's sort of essentially similar to the argument for plan conditionalization. If you have dispositions that are going to lead you to update in some way that will not give rise to this sort of situation where your current credences are sort of within the span of the your possible future credences, then there's alternative ones you could have had that end up being better for sure. Okay, so much for what the teleological approach can give us. One question you might naturally be asking at this point isn't the account of epistemic utility that I've given sort of impoverished? I said that the role of credences was just to represent, well, the kind of one of the roles of credences was just to represent the world, and that suggested that kind of what gave them epistemic utility, the epistemic utility of them, is just exhausted by how well they represent the world. But a natural thought, since as long ago as Plato, is that there's extra value to belief states that comes not just by having true beliefs representing the world well, but by having something more like knowledge or justification or stable belief or what other sort of range. So in the last 10 minutes, I'm just going to go through and say why I don't want to include that as a kind of extra source of epistemic value. And at this point, I'm sort of going to revert to the sort of full belief framework, the approach to epistemology where you think of represent people as having full beliefs. Partly because it's not obvious that we have a very clear notion of what knowledge amounts to in the credence framework, what it means for a credence to account, amount to knowledge. So Sarah Moss has a particular account of this, Jason Connick has a particular account of this, but there's not a sort of settled view of even what sort of property we're ascribing in that situation. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the full belief framework. So as I said, the thought that there's something more to epistemic utility than just of beliefs than just kind of how well they represent the world goes back at least to the Meno. But there's a kind of, I think there's an interesting feature of that passage in the Meno where Plato's kind of, or so Socrates is sort of asking, trying to answer the question, why is knowledge more valuable than true belief? And the interesting feature is it's not at all obvious that he's talking about knowledge in the sense that we're talking about now. So he's talking about belief that you can tie down by a reasoning out of the cause. So the idea is it's something like belief that you have some sort of explanation for and that you kind of, it gains a certain stability, that's going to be what he ends up thinking the kind of value of these things is, it gets a certain stability by you having an explanation of why the belief is true. So what it looks a lot more like is understanding. It may end up being knowledge, of course, but ultimately what he seems to be interested here is in understanding. And in that case, I think you might think, kind of drawing on Alison Hill's work actually, that the veritas, the kind of person who thinks that the kind of epistemic value of your beliefs is their kind of ability to represent the world or their accuracy in representing the world, the veritas has a reasonably good account of why understanding is better than mere true belief. Understand, you know, having a belief where you where it's both true but also you understand why it's true. And the reason is that if you look at Alison Hill's account, then you get the people who understand why a particular proposition that they believe is true also have a whole range of other true beliefs about it. You don't get understanding without also having a whole range of true beliefs. So if you understand if you compare a situation where someone understands why something's true versus having the true belief but not understanding it, then the veritist has a kind of natural account. There's just more accurate representation of the world in that situation. Okay, so much for the Meno. But of course, it's not that everyone who's talked about the kind of extra value of knowledge over true belief has just been kind of deferring to, you know, Plato's kind of, or Socrates's great insight and not had that intuition sort of for themselves. They have. So I want to have a think then about this intuition. So I think there are certain sorts of cases where I just don't think it really holds. So we could imagine something like Verity. What I know is that Verity was on a drive this afternoon. And she was either driving through real Barn County or she was driving through fake Barn County. But I don't know which. And I know that at some point in this drive, so in real Barn County, everything that looks like a barn is a barn. Fake Barn County, there's one thing that's a barn and everything else is a barn facade because it was used as a TV film studio. She's driving through and I know that at some point she looked to her right, she saw something that looked like a barn, she formed the belief it was a barn, and indeed it was a barn. That's what I know. And then I suppose I'm talking to someone and I ask, so was she driving through real Barn County or fake Barn County? And I learn, for instance, that she was driving through real Barn County. I can't imagine feeling a kind of sense of relief that, or a sense of, oh, that's excellent. She's kind of an extra bit of kind of epistemic value. I suppose Verity's one of my closest friends and I care about her well-being, including her epistemic well-being. It just doesn't seem to shift particularly for me, learning which of the two that she was in. She had a true belief then. So in that situation, it looks like Verity gets all of the good, all the things that we really care about just by getting the true belief. But you might think, well, that's just because, you know, she gets justification. It's really justification that's more valuable. So what about cases in which the belief is not justified? So you can imagine a case where Verity believes it's going to be sunny tomorrow and Violet also believes it's going to be sunny tomorrow. But Verity believes it because she's assiduously checked all the weather apps and she's kind of updated on the reliability of every single one. She's formed the belief that indeed it's going to be sunny tomorrow, as the weather apps indeed do suggest it will be. But Violet, on the other hand, is just wishful thinking. You know, she's kind of planning a hike up Ben McDewey tomorrow or something like that, and she just thought, gosh, I'd really wish it were sunny. That would make for a really nice day, and that's the reason she believes it. So we want to say in some ways, you might think you want to say in some ways that Verity has more valuable state than Violet does. So one of the kind of standard veritist solutions to this, putative veritist solutions to this, this puzzle is due to Goldman and Olson, which they call the conditional probability solution. So the thought is that Verity's crudal state is better, epistemically speaking, because it makes it more likely that other beliefs she later forms on the basis of similar evidence are true. I think there's a problem with that. I think it confuses that the effect that learning this fact about her beliefs has on my expected value, my expectation for her, the value of her future beliefs. It mistakes that for the value of the state of affairs that comes into being from having that future. So, you know, if I learn that verity has justification, then I presumably do indeed end up updating in a way that gives me a kind of higher expectation for her epistemic value in the future, because I think it's more likely that she's going to have true belief. But her, in fact, being justified doesn't make it more likely, doesn't cause it to be more likely. There's probably a common cause that's going on in that situation. So I think that doesn't quite work. So in the last couple of minutes, I just want to go through what I think this tells us. So what I essentially want to do in this case is just to give an error theory for this sort of situation. In fact, we shouldn't think that Verity's belief state is more valuable in that situation than Violet's is. But there's going to be some other things that are more valuable around it, and we end up mistaking those for this. And the way I'm going to do this is just by going quickly through Edward Craig's work on knowledge descriptions. I'm going to end up saying that I don't think Craig's right, but I think there's a kind of tweak to the solution which I think gets something close to right that's going to help us with this error theory. But in some sense, the error theory is going to be that when we judge something like justification or knowledge to be more valuable than true belief, we are doing something like making the mistake that Goldman and Olson make. We are attributing to the state a value because upon learning the state, our expectation of the value will rise. Okay, I think that's it's a natural mistake to make, and I think that's kind of in some ways the error theory for it. But let's just go through a little bit on Craig on knowledge description. So Craig has this view: the concept of knowledge is used to flag approved sources of information. So he's interested in this kind of functional. What's the functional role of ascribing knowledge? Says, human beings need true beliefs about their environment. That being so, they need sources of information that will lead them to true beliefs. It would be very advantageous if they can tap the primary stocks of their fellows as well as using their own perceptual sources. The strange thing about this, and there's more detail on the handout if people are interested, but if this is the role of ascribing knowledge of a particular proposition to someone, it doesn't seem to require the heavy-duty concept of knowledge with all, say, its kind of modal involvement. If I need to use someone in order to learn a particular proposition, so they have that, there's information I can glean by finding out what they believe about it, I don't need to know that they know it, I just need to know that they're correct about it. So Craig is sort of aware of a little bit of this problem. He says, well, that's the reason why what I'm really interested in is the ascriptions of knowledge whether. So I don't tell you, you know, S knows this particular proposition, because in that case I really could just have said, look, the proposition's true because it's entailed by that and doesn't have all the modal involvement. But he says, no, but you couldn't do that. What I'm interested in is ascriptions of knowledge whether, where I don't tell you whether the thing is true, I tell you that they're a good person to ask if I want to find out whether it's true. But again, the problem is you don't need knowledge whether in that situation, you just need that the person is right about it. I learn S is correct in their belief about X, whatever their belief about X is, then I can learn from them that. So what's going on in these cases? I've got a little bit more of an argument there that you don't need to kind of ascribe knowledge with its kind of modal implications. So what's going on? Instead, I think what happens in cases of knowledge ascription is that we're not flagging that the person is good informant about the particular proposition about which we're ascribing knowledge. We're not saying, when I say S knows whether X, I'm not giving you information that will be particularly useful in your inquiry into X. To do that, I would just need to say X has got the correct belief about X. Find out what it is and then update on that. Instead, what we're doing is we're telling you something about that person's, well, a number of things. We're telling you certain things about their kind of place in the world, what sort of evidence they have, what their informational environment is like. But also what kind of cognitive capacities they have, and what are their dispositions for using those cognitive capacities when they gain new evidence. And that sort of information is valuable. It's valuable not so that I can find out about X. I could have just you know, if I just label the person as someone who is correct about X, then I could tell whether they would be useful about X. But it gives me some information about whether they'd be good people to ask about related sorts of propositions about which the evidence we then thereby learn they have is going to be relevant to those propositions. Okay, so I think that ends up being the kind of genuine functional role of knowledge descriptions. And if we think something like that, then we kind of end up with this kind of something like the error theory for why, or something like an error theory for why we end up thinking that states of knowledge end up being more valuable. Why? Because it's a valuable thing to be able to learn of someone that they have this kind of knowledge, and we mistake that for thinking that the state that's being ascribed is valuable. But Georgie Gardner has this kind of really nice point that we've got hundreds of examples of cases where a practice of ascribing a particular property is very valuable, but the instantiation of the property itself is sometimes extremely unvaluable. She has the example of sexual harassment. Very valuable to have a practice of ascribing that concept, because it gives a huge amount of information about certain things. But of course, the thing being ascribed, the situation to which correct descriptions attach, is not something that's valuable. Now, of course, knowledge is not like that. It's not something that's possibly disvaluable to have in the way that sexual harassment is. But it is something that's not but it's something that you can't infer from the value of the practice of ascribing it to the value of the thing being ascribed. Okay, I'll wrap up there. Thanks very much.